Hi, this is Chris Evans recording another Storage Unpacked podcast. This week with Martin, just Martin and I. How are you doing, Martin?
Not bad. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm fine, yeah. Pretty good. I'm looking forward to that slow run down into winter. Dave's not happy about being outside anymore.
No.
Only seeing very occasionally when the sun comes out, so I think he'll have to come indoors at some point.
It's still quite warm. I think we might get a bit of an Indian summer.
I hope so. I'd rather have him outside than inside, to be honest. He's a climber now.
I was pointing out to somebody at work today that there wasn't that many weeks to Christmas, just to cheer everybody up.
There'll be even fewer when we publish this as well.
I know.
Okay, so this week, it's just you and I, and we thought we would take a moment to reflect on some of the news that came out of VMworld this year. So VMworld 2018. Now, I wasn't there personally, and I'm guessing you weren't there either.
No, I try and avoid VMworld, to be honest.
It is in Las Vegas. I mean, next year it's in San Francisco. I'm tempted to think about going back, but it hits that awkward time of the holidays, doesn't it? Landing on the August bank holiday for us.
Yeah, we always end up killing our bank holidays. So if there's any American people out there who are organising big shows and things, can you actually go and look at the British calendar and avoid our bank holidays, please?
Yes, exactly. So having said that, I did have a quick look and see the news that came out. I was actually at home, I think, when the event was on. One of the things I thought was really interesting was the fact that one of AWS's key original storage offerings, shall we call it, it's a database one, but it's not quite storage, but not far off, is now available to be run on premises, which I know it's not the first thing they've done. We'll talk about one of the other things they've done in a moment, but it's certainly probably the first service they've done. And that's RDS, which is the relational database service. So what we thought we'd do is we talk about what that is today, what it really means to run that on-prem when it's a service, how does that even work? And what does it really mean for the future? What do you think, Martin?
Yeah, it's an interesting, we appear to have this unholy alliance building between the guerrilla of on-premises virtualization. They like to sort of call themselves cloud, but they're really just a virtualization engine, I would suggest, VMware. And then we've got the 50-ton guerrilla of AWS, who are the public cloud monster. You wonder what they've got to get out of it. I'm sure we'll probably come to some conclusions on this. But AWS moving into the data center, VMware, is it a defensive position? Who knows?
Yeah, we'll get to that, I guess. So first of all, let's just set the scene for anybody who's not 100% aware of what RDS actually is. And I guess the clue's in the name, the Relational Database Service. And actually what it is, in a nutshell, is really a service that runs a database in an AWS instance in the cloud. So rather than you build the instance yourself and install the software and run it and buy the licenses and so on, you buy the service and AWS run it on your behalf. And that means that they're doing everything behind the scenes. So all the things that you would normally do as a database admin to support it, things like the creation, the patching, the backups, data protection, all that sort of stuff, all of that's handled for you. Now, currently, the service supports a number of different database flavors. So it's not just like one database. So they support Oracle, they support MySQL, SQL Server, MariaDB, Postgres, and their own, I think they call it a MySQL-like database, Aurora.
Yeah, Aurora. So it's very similar to MySQL.
Yeah. But Aurora comes in two flavors, doesn't it? You can get the MySQL one. I think you can get a Postgres one now as well. Yeah. But that's basically Amazon saying, hey, we forked our own database, so come and use ours because it's cheaper for us to run than it is for you. So ultimately, RDS takes away a lot of that overhead. And actually, I think there are some quite good things within it that make it quite practical to use. What do you think, Martin?
Yeah, I think RDS is one of the more interesting services. If we take it into the DevOps movement just quickly, if you talk to DevOps people, the one thing they don't understand is databases. Everything else I think they understand, but databases is one thing they put their hand up that I understand. So it was a very logical thing for Amazon to do back in the day, certainly as they pushed this to a developer-first type environment. And then for them to bring it on, it almost feels like Amazon basically shipping a load of database appliances.
Yeah, so it is one of their early services. I think 2009 this came out. So it's about 9 years old, so it's pretty old. In that relative term, if you know what I mean. And I think you're right. I think the ability just to say, I need a database, I can spin one up. I don't have to think what that really means. And all I get is a connection and I can connect to the database and off I go and log in and use it is great. Now, the one thing I think is really interesting is that the pricing is all based on a per hour cost, just like it would be if you're running a VM or anything else. And that's really interesting when you look at the licensing side of things, because if you are a company that is, say, licensing SQL Server or Oracle or something like that, maintaining the license set, I would imagine, is quite hard. Now, there were techniques to do that with things like Windows, so you could have licensed servers. I don't know whether the same thing exists in Oracle or SQL Server. I don't know whether you know that at all, Martin.
You tend not to. Basically, as far as I can see, with Oracle and SQL Server, you could realistically get away with installing as many instances as you like. And at some point, the vendor will turn up and audit you and say, by the way, you owe us this because you're not compliant with your license or your license agreement. I like the RDS service. I think it's really interesting. I also think it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays on premises.
What do we think the negatives of it are? The most obvious one must be, you know, it's got restricted support. You can't run every single possible flavor. But then that's not really a surprise. I would imagine most IT organizations would limit the number of different flavors of engine that they would support anyway.
Yeah, so if you actually look at it, so we're supporting Oracle, as you said, MySQL, SQL Server, MariaDB, which is really MySQL anyway, Postgres, and then their own flavors. You'll probably find most enterprises have 2, 3, 4 at most of those flavors anyway, and that's just for historical reasons. Most enterprises will be having Oracle and SQL Server, I suspect, with some variant of MySQL floating around.
Yeah, and for the OCD people out there, or those who like to have control over everything, what do we call those? Control freaks?
Yak shavers, I think a term is often used.
Yeah, could be. Yeah. There's obviously no access to the VM itself. The whole point of this is that Amazon are doing the work, and behind the scenes, you don't get even to touch it. So you shouldn't be touching it. But that, you know, I guess people who have issues with control, that could be a problem for them. I do think that there is one area you do have to consider, and that's SLAs. Clearly, there's a limited SLA in terms of uptime, which is about 99.95%. I worked out that's 21 minutes a month downtime, which isn't much. But obviously, that might be an issue for you. And if it is down longer than that, you're getting service credits. But then that's the same with every cloud feature, isn't it? There's no difference there.
I get what you're saying. But if you even look at on-premises, 99.95%. If you look at a lot of on-premises people, they'll be designing their data bases to be available probably 4 nines. So you get the odd people 5 nines and 6 nines. You're not far off it. 21 minutes per month downtime. I suspect if we were to look historically that Amazon do better than this, substantially better than this. And I'm probably thinking 4 or 5 nines is probably fairly common.
And I think you're right, because actually, if you go back and look at some of the storage features, the difference between the SLA and the actual target uptime are totally different. There's at least an order of magnitude difference. And that just shows you that, you know, you're going to write an SLA that you know you can meet. You're not going to write an SLA you have to pay out on every month. So the chances are you're always going to set the SLA bar lower than the actual bar of what you potentially can achieve. There's just one other thing I would say on this, though, that I think is really interesting. And that whilst I was thinking about our subject matter for today, I went back and looked at a blog post I wrote, I think, about 18 months ago. And if you remember a company called Instapaper, do you remember them?
I do indeed.
They went off somewhere and came back again. They got purchased by somebody, didn't they? They were interesting because they had a big outage and they were running on RDS. And the reason they had an outage is because their database basically got so big that it hit the size of the file system that the EC2 instance was deployed on. And then everything breaks because obviously you can't expand the database, you can't insert new records. And they didn't really know how the whole thing was working. And they'd been using snapshots as their backups. Of course, the file system was broken and the snapshots that you would recover from were in the file system that was broken. So that caused them a lot of heartache and a lot of outage. So the only thing I think you have to remember with any service is trying to understand exactly how it might be implemented and where the risk points are.
Yeah, I mean, you still need to understand there are some inherent limits and things when you're dealing with a database. So you need to understand a little bit about that database. Probably you don't have to understand as much, obviously, but some of the nitty-gritty bits where you're going to employ Oracle experts or SQL Server experts, you probably don't need to know anymore.
Yeah, and there's the difference. I think ultimately there's a difference between understanding a service so you can use it and actually needing to know the internals of a platform in order to get the best out of it. And there's, a big difference between the two things.
Yeah, I'm sure there's plenty of people out there who are listening who will be very uncomfortable with this idea. Oracle DBAs like to be able to fiddle and tweak. They like to argue with storage teams about where their data should be placed. But as soon as you go to a service, you don't have any of that. You can't decide that you want your log systems on separate LUNs. That's not the way it works anymore. So I think with some of the things which DBAs won't be able to see, they're going to feel rather miffed about. It doesn't necessarily take away from their prime skill, which should be tuning queries.
And who doesn't like a good argument with a DBA about whether you should be using RAID 5 or RAID 1?
Yeah. separate LUNs. Or we all need separate LUNs, but
we all need separate LUNs.
Shared spindles or shared bits of flash these days anyway, so you don't get separate LUNs anymore.
Yeah, we're not still using disk drives, guys.
Yeah.
Never mind. There you go. Anyway, so Okay, let's move on and talk about RDS on premises. So what was actually announced and what is it? So from the limited information I've managed to find about this and the very, very brief blog post that's been produced on it, it appears that this is effectively RDS running on your vSphere environment in your data center. And that means somehow, and we'll talk about how that's going to work in a minute because there's a million and one questions come out here, somehow your VMware environment is connected to AWS by a VPN or by Direct Connect. And somehow, I guess, AWS are continuing to do the maintenance on this. Just seems like getting your head around how something that is a service in the cloud where the vendor supports the entire environment, now having that running on your premises seems a bit odd to get your head around.
It's very hard to get your head around. The packaging format, how is it going to get onto your system? Maintenance windows, how this is all going to work? I'm struggling with a bit. I mean, the beauty about AWS for instance, if you want to increase your CPUs, you can do so. And Amazon do all the capacity management for you as such. They're capacity managing their environment. You bring this onto your premises and you're going to have to do all that side of things. But for something which you don't necessarily have very much control of.
Well, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? So first of all, this image, presumably that they must ship you templates or images that you can build from.
Yeah.
And it would make sense that that's shipped and stored on your VMware environment in some form in order to save bandwidth across the network. So somehow they're shipping you an image that then is going to get spun up. And that's going to be around a certain set of fixed parameters, size-wise, and CPU and RAM and all the rest of it. What happens when you want to change that? Who's going to change it? How is it going to change? Is that going to be somebody from Amazon dialing in or linking into your environment and changing that on your behalf? Don't know. But as you said, at that point, if something's changing, you've got a third party in your environment changing the parameters of your environment outside of your control, which you normally wouldn't allow somebody to do.
I think there's a load of other interesting things for Amazon to look at. There's some interesting opportunities for people. Obviously, they can break that image down. If you've got it on your own system, you can inspect it yourself. You can see what Amazon are doing. As they're maintaining things, you can inspect, depending on how we're doing it. If it's encrypted, you might not be able to, but you'll be able to pick up packets, and people may use this as a way to actually discover more about how AWS itself works internally.
Now, that's an interesting point. So, yeah, what you're saying in some respects is that, yes, I agree with you that you could do this for good reasons, but actually you could do it for nefarious reasons, and actually it could allow you to work out an attack surface into Amazon itself. And actually hacking into their environment. That's interesting.
It is interesting. And then there's the whole maintenance thing. So obviously Amazon will, who knows, Amazon or VMware, how are we going to do the maintenance and keep those images up to date? What level of control do you have as a consumer of this service? It feels like a very different thing to have a service running on your own hardware where you don't necessarily have control, as opposed to as soon as you run it in the public cloud, you kind of accept the fact that you have no control about patch levels or anything. Amazon can do what they like. But when it gets onto your stuff, you may be feeling, and it may just be an emotional thing for customers to get used to, but you've got something on your own site which you don't have control of. You don't know what the patching is. If there is a security problem, where is the responsibility for that?
And this applies, I think, to anything that you would run as a service on your own platform. It doesn't necessarily have to be a database service. We could be having this discussion about vendors putting storage hardware in your data center or anything. There's a degree of control you expect when it belongs to you that you don't expect to be taken away from you. Mm. And you're right. I think as an end user, you're going to have to get yourself over that somehow and get past that sort of that typical view we would normally be used to having, that when it's on my data center, in my data center, I own it.
Pricing is going to be interesting and billing will be interesting.
Let's separate the two out, first of all, because on the one hand, pricing, how do you price it? Because within an AWS environment, the build of those EC2 instances that you run on are pretty standard.
Yeah.
You know, it's up to Amazon how they actually build that behind the scenes, but clearly they are charging a standard price and it's up to them how they build that. They could build it with cheaper servers from one generation to the next. That's entirely up to them. But when it's on your site, you could have all sorts of different processor models that, I guess, let's just think about that though. If you've got a virtual CPU, would it be dependent on the speed of the processor?
Well, it is.
It is, isn't it? So
unless you have a pool, unless they're doing something with a pool, and then don't you can almost define the size of a pool in gigahertz.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm just trying to think through, that effectively, there's going to be need to be some sort of standardized measure that they're using for that. And potentially that is the gigahertz measure that, or the megahertz measure that says, this is what we base it on. Yeah. And that's how we do the charging. You know, maybe it's just a straight line. Maybe there's a you know, some sort of sliding scale, like you get some sort of discount the more you have. But somehow they're going to have to go in there and at least record that information on a regular basis. Now, maybe it'll be done at shutdown and start of a VM. So every time it comes up and down, maybe it'll heartbeat and talk back to Amazon every day, every hour, every minute to say it's still alive and still running. You know, within their data center, I guess they've got to have a way of doing it, but they've got to have a different way of doing it when it's on your site, because there's no guarantee A, that you're always going to have that link that's valid. And also you could, you know, you could hide it behind firewalls. There could be other things you have to open up to make this work properly.
Yeah. And what it looks like if you have a mixed environment, I'm not quite sure. I mean, for the licensing, obviously, so for the RDS, you're paying on a per minute or per hour, however they're going to charge for it. But I can conceivably see people have an RDS service and say native Oracle, and how that's going to show up on audit and what conflicts there. That's going to be interesting to see.
I wonder what Oracle and Microsoft think about this in general, because they're the only two out of the actual supported platforms that are, if you like, third-party databases that are owned by somebody else. MySQL's obviously open source, MariaDB is open source, Postgres is open source, and Amazon's Aurora is just Amazon, is their own stuff as well. So the only two, if you like, in inverted commas or air quotes, commercial products are SQL Server and Oracle. So I wonder what their view is on the idea of this, because as we get on to what the benefits are for the customers, I do think that there's an opportunity for a customer to reduce their costs significantly, and that might be a massive downer for Oracle and Microsoft in this instance.
Yeah, I can see how you would, because obviously with an Oracle and then Microsoft license, you're paying per core generally, and not based on it's not based on a usage. So if you say you have 16 cores worth of Oracle are billing that base, and you'll assume you're running it 24/7. Now with a service, you might not be. You might have your production servers which are running 24/7. But your test servers are actually only running 9 to 5 when the developers and the test teams are in. With a service, it allows you to turn it off easily, and there's a reason to do so. With the traditional Oracle license, there's no real reason to do so.
There is a scenario there you could look at, though, and you could challenge that, and you could say that potentially if you go to somebody and you buy a perpetual license, a license that allows you to run 24/7 on whatever the hardware is that you've actually bought, potentially that might look actually cheaper than it would be if you bought it per hour. You know, there's potentially a premium for the per hour service. Having said that, that really then comes down to how inefficient you run.
Yeah. So I think we're going to end up with more jobs for IT accountants, people who can do this complex calculation between is it cheaper to run as a service, more effective to run as a service, or do I run it on premises and with a traditional license model? I quite like the idea of going to a service, because it would stop us having to put up with the annual or biannual Oracle audit or Microsoft audit to work out how many cores or how many instances we've got running. Whereas if we're just paying for a service, you never know, it may actually pay for itself in the lack of the 4 months of hell while you try and work out what your utilization is like on your Oracle, and everybody runs around to work out which instances they can turn off.
And from your perspective, I don't know how many teams you've got internally that are taking database services from IT, but I would imagine also this has potentially got a huge significant benefit in helping billing actually be run. So from the point of view of actually saying, well, that one belongs to you, that belongs to you, that belongs to you, now it's a lot easier because you can attribute it to a VM, and you've got an object against which you can actually bill a lot more easily, I think.
Yeah.
I think that potentially is quite good, because obviously you're almost just doing pass-through from the bill you'll get from Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. I think it simplifies that. I think it simplifies a whole load of things. I'll be interested to see how the availability model works. Traditionally, on premises, you've got some kind of database cluster. It'll be interesting to see how it's designed into VMware. Is it using VMware's internal availability tools, or are they doing something clever?
I can probably give you a little bit of extra background on that one. So I had a quick look around at a few different bits and pieces, some videos today, and some other bits of research. And I know the way that RDS works on premises today is that for a lot of the platforms, it literally just replicates an EBS volume that's got the database stored on it. So if your VM, your EC2 instance dies, the EBS volume that it was running against is replicated somewhere else to another availability zone, and they just bring it up on there. So I guess it's effectively like a crash copy.
Yeah.
You can also take snapshots. So that's another option. Now, I did watch something else today as well that talked about, it was actually an interview with some of the guys who work in the storage business unit at VMware, and they were saying that they can rely on some of the underlying storage features of something like vSAN to allow people, I don't think it just has to be vSAN, but vSAN was one that was mentioned, in order to actually take copies of the database in different ways. So there could be some integration there that we've still yet to see that could come out.
Yeah, I think the devil will be in the detail on this one.
Yeah, so let's park that for a moment and let's move on and have a think about who's getting some benefit out of this here. Because I think this is a really interesting one. I'll tell you what, we'll start with the customer because I think that's relatively easy to answer and that probably helps us go on to the other pieces. I think if I was a customer, I would look at it, and you are a customer, by the way, Martin, so I think you can explain that one in a minute. But if I was a customer, I would be looking at it thinking, this potentially could save me money, time, effort. I don't necessarily think it means I can suddenly throw away all the DBAs tomorrow. That's fair enough. But what it does allow me to do is have them focusing on something perhaps more useful. But I think more importantly, I think operationally, the billing side of it, the charging side of it, and the risk of not knowing what you might be charged for in the future, I think as a customer, it really helps me there. And one other little bit I'll add on just to the very end of it, and then I'll let you tell me what you think. And that's, if I was a customer that was looking to work out how I got off some of this technology and moved on to something cheaper, I might actually use this as a leverage point to say, tell you what we'll do. We'll start moving our databases into Oracle as a service on something like RDS. And then over time, we'll look at how easy it might be to do conversions of that database into something a bit cheaper. So I think I could see people looking at that as a scenario as well.
Yeah, I tend to agree. So I think it could simplify the visibility of the licensing. So if you're subscribing to service and that's the only thing you allow people to do, it means you don't have random Oracle databases or SQL Server databases popping up left, right and centre. So I think that's an advantage. It does simplify the management, hopefully, of your database environment. It frees up, as I say, DBAs to do more sensible things, looking at how indexing or what queries are bad, understanding more of that rather than trying to tune hardware, because they still do. Then there is a potential infrastructure simplification. DBAs can actually focus on doing things which add value to the business, like speeding up queries, looking at indexing, diving in depth, because developers are notoriously bad at writing SQL queries. They'll do things like full table scans for no real reason. They have no idea how to index. It means it's much more of an intellectual pursuit. I think that's good. And then it's an interesting stepping off point for those people who are thinking that cloud may be in their future. So if you can start seeing how you're going to consume something as a service, but it's on premises, if you then want to move into Amazon or even Azure or something like that, it's a good start for you to understand what a consumption model looks like. And it gives you a better idea, because a lot of people worry about moving into cloud, about how much extra it's going to cost them. What does their billing look like? What does the service utilization really look like? So you will be able to do that and potentially turn off services overnight, really start to hone your environment. So a cloud migration becomes better. I was talking to somebody earlier today about this, but I think many cloud deployments fail and people move back is because they've not really thought about how to change the way they do infrastructure, how they provision service. So what they do is they do a lift and shift and they just treat AWS, GCP, Azure as a big VM farm. If you do that, I think you're probably going to, you're not going to save any money and you're probably not going to get any benefit of the cloud. You might sort of just stuck with an on-premises solution. So I think it's a good entry-level drug.
Yeah, it's definitely that. It's definitely an opportunity to say, come and try this out and see what you think. Yeah. What do VMware get out of it, though? I mean, the only thing I can think so far is that from their perspective, I mean, they don't really care what you run on it, I guess, on their platform. You're running stuff. But I'm not sure it's exactly what VMware are getting out of this.
I don't know myself, unless there is something along the lines that people are thinking, or VMware are thinking, well, we allow IT shops to pretend they're more cloudy than they actually are. So that's a very cynical view of it. And it means that vCA may look a little bit more cloudy. I can't see them using, I can't see why you would use VMware on AWS and then run RDS on top of this. I think that would make no sense at all. So I'm not quite sure what VMware gets to. I think AWS is a big winner in all this.
And one other thing I would say, that on the VMware side, it's going to be interesting to see what they're thinking in terms of strategy, because they bought Cloud Health Technologies, didn't they, just recently, and that was announced at VMworld. It's just interesting to guess where they're headed with their entire environment. Is there a play where they're trying to become hybrid again, where they're trying to build a hybrid environment without actually building out data centers and environments, and therefore build into their offering something that allows you to manage places like AWS and actually cooperate with them, and therefore build a more holistic hybrid environment, even if they don't build out that infrastructure themselves.
Well, the other thing is what VMware may just get more revenue out of this, just on the grounds that but they're now actually charging you to tell the time of your own watch. So depending who's going to own the billing, and it's a service, so it's obviously going to be a recurring charge. So customer provides the hardware, syncs all the CapEx costs, VMware and Amazon provide you an appliance which then runs on your hardware, and then they charge you to run something on your own hardware on a recurring revenue basis. That's quite an interesting idea. It seems a work of genius to me.
And there's possibly the very interesting angle you've just highlighted. And that's this idea of going back into running a recurring service that you can charge for.
Yeah.
So I know that a huge amount of VMware's revenue comes from license maintenance and so on, but I'm sure we'd all like to have recurring revenue. And you see that on all the other SaaS platforms. You look at everything from Adobe to, well, Salesforce or anything like that. You know, they're all predicated on the gym membership, aren't they?
Yeah.
You pay a certain amount a month and they hope you won't use the service as much as you do. But even if you don't use it, you're still paying something every month. Now, I know that's not entirely what we're talking about here, because you could switch VMs off and stuff. But actually, in reality, I would imagine you find that most people won't. Mm. Most people won't be as efficient as they possibly could be with running this on premises. And there will still be lots of stuff that will get left switched on all the time.
Yeah, I think so. Certainly from VMware's point of view, it allows them to do that service provider thing which they've tried before, but with a lot less risk and sinking a lot less cost.
Final question then. What's in this for Amazon? I mean, okay, I think the obvious thing is that they're encroaching into the data center. But is that really what they want to do? Do we really think that Amazon, or AWS, I should say, I suppose, really wants to become an infrastructure provider in the data center? Or is this more about either selling services into the data center and or that ability to suck data out of the data center?
I think they're building beachheads to suck stuff out. So I think they're doing just enough, like things like they've done with their Snowball devices. These are edge devices. They're encouraging you and enabling you to shift more and more of your workload into the cloud. If you're running RDS as a service on your VMware, eventually Amazon will get a chance to come out and say, well, you could run it in our cloud at this cost. It could be cheaper. Environmentally, it might be more friendly for you. There's less space. So I can see why Amazon would want to do this, and it will play quite well with the enterprise. Certainly those people who are very suspicious about things. I imagine they'll sell this to developers. I think they'll push this very hard at developers as another stick to beat their infrastructure teams with. So yeah, I think it's a very smart move for Amazon. I think there's only one real winner in this, and that's Amazon.
Yeah, think about things you could do with that VM or that environment you're pushing to the customer site. As soon as you push it to the customer site, you're having to keep track of all of the VMs that you're running your database in. You now know how big those databases are, how much storage they're using, how often they're used, how frequently the queries are run. You know a huge amount of stuff about them that you could then give back to the customer free. Yeah, that's fine. But then actually use to market back at them and say, do you know what? You're running Oracle and you're running the database like this. If you ran it on our environment, it would actually be 20% cheaper. You're potentially giving the data that allows you to sell back to the customer.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know what metrics potentially they get access to. Probably quite a lot, because they can argue they should be getting quite a lot of this back for billing purposes. But then you can start to analyze and say, you know, you do realize that in average, your database servers are actually only busy 40% of the time. So why don't you move it to our service? Why don't you move to something like a serverless database service where it's only triggered when it's been utilized? So things like that start to come into play. And Amazon can collect a lot more information about data centers, which they don't have at the moment.
Yeah, there's a good example of that. If you look at the limitations that are placed on RDS at the moment, yeah. I believe that if you spin an instance up that's an Oracle RDS instance, you can only run one database on it. Yeah. If you run SQL Server, you can do up to 30. But all the other environments, that the open source ones, you can do as many as you like. Now, you can see a very easy way for somebody to come back and say, do you know what, here's a great way to consolidate down what you're doing. Come and move it all onto our platform and we'll help you do the conversion. And we'll even run the conversion tool for you, which you can run in your own site. And you could even not even take the risk of moving it into the cloud. You could run a conversion between one of the databases you're running on-prem to another one on your own site and see how it works. And if you don't like it, you could just delete it. Or you could migrate it up to us. So I think you're right. There's lots of opportunities to sell. And I think this is a land grab into the data center to pull stuff out and drag more back into the core of AWS. I don't think Amazon want to be the next hardware provider and sell tin to people, because I don't think I think there's no benefit to them in doing that whatsoever.
I don't think there's any benefit to the world of them doing that, to be honest. So I think it's a smart move for them. I think it furthers the cloud agenda. That's not something I have a huge problem with. I don't have a huge problem with anything which upsets the incumbent database vendors. And certainly as you start providing things as a service, I suspect we may it could have a big knock on Oracle and Microsoft as developers start to look and say, well, I'm just consuming this as a service. I don't really care about whether my DBAs are Postgres experts, because I'm not asking them to install it and maintain it. It's all done by somebody else.
You get the wisdom of that knowledge. So Amazon must be running, I mean, I think they've talked about 80,000 migrations into RDS from on-prem. Yeah. But just think of that shared knowledge they've got there of so many customers, so many environments, so many configurations. They're like the expert at how to do that. Yeah. So there's a benefit in actually going with them rather than not going with them, because you get all that sort of that shared knowledge. Yeah. Wonderful. Okay, so I'll tell you what we should do. We should actually say, if anybody who is an actual DBA, because neither you nor I are DBAs, wants to come and talk to us about it, it'd be really interesting to see what they think. But I think in general, I think the other angle I'd be interested to understand is if anybody else thinks there are other services that Amazon could do this to as well.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting thing. Is this just a start? I mean, this is a very old service, which Amazon's understand very well. What other services may they start to put in? I have noticed that there are more and more references to on-premises where you may run something in Amazon, but the idea is it spans your Amazon environment and also your on-premises environment. So Amazon are trying to glue the on-premises data center and their cloud offerings together more and more. So what other services could go across? Like, could they do something with storage or something entirely different? I mean, for instance, you can actually download and run Amazon Linux if you so wish.
I think on that note, we'll leave everybody just hanging there and we'll see what we see if we can come up with something. So thanks for that, Martin. Great conversation. As usual, everybody can find us online at storageunpacked.com, at Storage Unpacked on Twitter, in LinkedIn if you search for us as Storage Unpacked. And obviously, if you're listening to us through iTunes, please go on and put a recommendation and make it a 5, because we'd really be happy to have more people have access to our content. That would be wonderful. So thanks again for listening. Thanks again, Martin.
Yeah, cheers, Chris.